The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 64 of The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, hot-blooded with the heat of the plains that bred me, silent as gun smoke, a stranger to all but the surly dog at my side. The surly dog is Maggie. She is at my side right now. She's asleep on the floor beside me. Surly? Meh. That might be a bit harsh, but she does have a mind of her own. I'll give her that. Got a great show for you today. The author Scott Eyman. I might say the best-selling author, Scott Eyman, because at the moment he has not one but two books on the New York Times bestseller list. Now, speaking of as someone who's never had a single book on the New York Times bestseller list, this is very impressive to me, and I am so proud of him. I've known him for a long time, and this is great news. The one book, of course, is his latest, John Wayne, The Life and Legend, which was published earlier this month in April and has been getting great reviews and selling great. And that's how you get on the New York Times bestseller list, by all those things. And then he co-wrote a book with Robert Wagner, the actor, called You Must Remember This. And it's on the New York Times bestseller list. So kudos to Scott Eyman. What a great month for him, and what a great year for him, and what a great guy. I've known Scott for a long, long time. I will not say that we have been bosom buddies, because he lives in Florida and I live in Los Angeles, and we see each other very, very, very rarely. As a matter of fact, I was trying to put a fine point on it and think of the last time that we actually saw each other in person, and it could be close to 20 years. We were at the New York Film Festival in probably 1990 or 91, I recall we went to see a new Eric Rohmer film, and we sat together, and as we were leaving, I had enjoyed it very much, and Scott nodded, and he said, well, sometimes paint dries in more interesting ways than other times, so I think he liked it too, but it was an Eric Rohmer film after all. But we have kept in touch, and I followed his career with great interest and read all of his books, and it's an impressive list of books. He's written biographies, of course, of Mary Pickford, Ernst Lubitsch, Louis B. Mayer, John Ford. Also wrote a terrific book on the coming of sound called The Speed of Sound, which came out at roughly the same time that the John Ford book did. So he's always done first-rate work, and I always enjoy talking with him, and we had a good time. I want to remind you that there are a couple of ways that you can help out support the podcast. One is financially, of course. You could go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and there's a donate button, and you just click on that. It'll take you to PayPal, and you can give us whatever you feel comfortable with to help keep us rolling along, and that would be very nice and very much appreciated. However, you don't have to give money. You can simply give your goodwill, and you do that by spreading the word to friends and going on Twitter and Facebook and all the other places that you go and tell people to listen to the podcast. And most crucially, you can go to iTunes, leave a 5-star rating, and also a nice review, as I just got this week from S. Rivers 7. Don't know who this is personally, but I consider him or her to be my closest friend on earth, because he or she wrote, I've learned more about the history of film listening to this podcast than I have from reading dozens of novels and watching hundreds of films. Frank Thompson is a national treasure. I think that bears repeating. Frank Thompson is a national treasure. His ability to make film history fun and accessible is commendable. And his rapport with the guests makes the conversations an absolute joy to listen to. Now that is a good review. S. Rivers 7, you are to be lauded above all people, as far as I'm concerned. And when we next meet, I shall greet you with a hearty hand clasp. That is my pledge. Don't you all want to be like S. Rivers 7? I think you do. I think S. Rivers 7 is the model that we should all aspire to. So go to iTunes, leave a nice review, help spread the word, because only by building an audience can we keep this thing going. And I really do want to keep it going. I've been having the most wonderful time doing this podcast. The fact that it's still a rather intimate proposition is okay, but I would like it to go a little farther into at least a couple of corners of the earth, and you can help us do that, so I hope you will. So, enjoy this conversation with Scott Eyman, and I'll see you on the other side. I've been racking my brain trying to remember when we met, because it's got to be 25 years plus.
Easily.
So, it was before you started writing books.
Or maybe just about the time I started writing books.
It had to be just, the Pickford came out about 1990?
Yeah, it was 1990. Okay. I started working on it in like, oh God, let me see. I moved to Florida in 83. And I started working on the Pickford in like 85, about 85. And that came out in 90. Because I couldn't find a publisher for the longest time. Because no one wanted to get anywhere near it. And my agent kept pushing and peddling and peddling and peddling. And finally, she found a publisher, a crazy, crazy old bastard named Donald I. Fine, whose claim to fame was he discovered Elmore Leonard, which was true.
Wow.
Donald Fine bought the book for one reason and one reason only. He didn't think he could make a dime on it. But the first movie he ever saw was Sparrows. And he remembered it like most people remember Bambi or Pinocchio. You know, to him, that was a terrifying motion picture experience. And that was the reason he bought the book. And it got a good review in People magazine, of all places. And because he paid me so little money. I mean, it was like enough to maybe get on a plane to Buffalo and back, as long as I didn't eat anything. But the book earned out in like 4 months, 5 months, because he paid me so little. And actually, it was quite a lucrative book for both of us, completely unintentionally, you know. Because I wrote the book because I wanted to write a book about silent movies. It was my great passion, and actually still is. And I looked around and I thought, well, who hasn't had a good book written about them that made silent movies? Well, Chaplin was out because there were a couple good books on Chaplin. And
sure.
Harold Lloyd was out, and Keaton was out, because I didn't want to necessarily just, you know, write, like so many people, write another book about Betty Davis or another book about Joan Crawford, which says nothing. Or they, in order to differentiate themselves, they pile on some outrageous thing, like Errol Flynn was a Nazi.
Yeah. You know,
that kind of thing. And I didn't want to do that. So, but I thought Pickford had been badly served by her biographer, so I just kind of chose her, picked her name out of a hat. And it was fun, and I had a great time with her. And I was off. That was it.
Now, you started writing on film. You and I must be around the same age, I would think.
I'm 46.
Yeah, I'm 36.
Good, so. You look great. You look really
you.
Great.
But I didn't really start writing until I started working on the Wellman book, which was around 78.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really start researching film.
So I beat you by a couple of years.
Yeah.
Because I interviewed John Wayne in August of 72.
Yeah.
When I was 21. And that was my first trip to L.A. And at that year, I interviewed John Wayne, Bill Wellman, Bill Clothier, Fritz Lang. I think that was it. It was a short week, short 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I started, you know, trying to sell them. Usually, you know, to small film magazines, Focus on Film or,
sure.
or Take One or something. And I was off. And the books were actually way in the distance, not the middle distance, the
yeah.
far distance, because it was tough enough, because I didn't have any money, and it was tough enough to work up this grant. And you didn't make any money writing for film magazines. I mean, they'd send you $150, you know, for a cover
sure.
story. So that wasn't going to work out. So I had to figure out some sort of financial predicate by which I could do these kinds of interviews, and not starve to death. Which was essentially involved working for a living, where the writing became my passion project.
Sure. Now, how did you arrive with that first list of people? Because the first three are very intertwined in many
mm-hmm,
ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Fritz Lang doesn't have much to do with the other three,
mm-hmm.
But did you? I mean, was there much rhyme for reason?
They were just people I admired. They were just people whose work I admired for one reason or another. I always thought Clothier was an underrated cameraman. Still do.
Sure.
Still an underrated cameraman. Fritz Lang, I just think, is one of the greatest directors. Wayne, I was a kind of a changeling now that I look back on myself. Because it was, the, you know, in the 1960s when I was a teenager, I saw everything. I mean, I went to see biker movies and I went to see everything. But, you know, I had a special affection for The Sons of Katie Elder and The War Wagon,
sure,
and those kinds of pictures. All those comfort westerns that he was basically spent the last 15 years of his life making. You know, and I went to see Easy Rider, too, and Bonnie and Clyde and all that. But I was even then, I was kind of like drawn to the older stuff or the throwback stuff. I can't conceptualize why. It was just the way I was, my affinities.
Yeah. Since I never got to meet Wellman, you've got to fill me in on what that experience was like.
He was a riot. He was spiky because he was watching a golf match. He was watching a golf tournament, and he was a big Lee Trevino fan. And he had to turn off the golf match to talk to me, you know, which he did.
Yeah.
But he was getting restless after 90 minutes because he wanted to see, you know, who was ahead. So, I could tell he was getting a little antsy. He wasn't as tall as I thought he'd be. You know, he was like 5'10".
Yeah.
You know, Kevin in, I think, Parades Gone By described him as like John Wayne. Well, no, he wasn't like John Wayne at all. He was about 5'10". And he was probably shorter than that because he was very old at this point. And, you know, you lose an inch or two. But he wasn't at all as massive as I'd been led to believe. But he was every bit as combative and assertive verbally. And it was a nice house. It was in his den. And he had his scripts, you know, leather-bound scripts on the shelves. I didn't help myself and look at any.
They're fun.
That was actually the only sign of a directorial career that I saw in the house. There was nothing. Of course, he'd been retired for a long time at this point. He hadn't made a movie in 14 years, 15 years, a long time.
At least,
since 57, 58. So it was receding into the distance rapidly. And, you know, he was arthritic. He was stiff and grumbly. He was an entertaining old guy. But he was an old guy.
Yeah.
There was no question. But, I mean, you can just imagine him 30 or 40 years earlier, get out of the way. You know, because he was assertive, he was spiky, he was a lot of fun, he was funny. I don't know that he would have been funny if he was the butt of the joke, though. That might have been a problem. I don't know to what extent his humor extended inward. But as I said, it was only 90 minutes, and I would have been happy to stay there all afternoon.
Yeah.
But he wanted to get back to Lee Trevino and see if Trevino was going to win the golf tournament.
You got to have your priorities.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. And he was a little bemused by people like me who wanted to talk to him, because I remember he said, you know, if I had to depend on people who know who Bill Wellman is, I'd starve to death. I would have starved to death. My kids would have starved to death. He said, you know, but all these people want to talk about Bill Wellman, about Bill Wellman movies. And he didn't think of himself as an auteur in that sense, you know, especially because he basically, the only thing he really prided himself on was making every kind of movie. And sometimes he just took a movie, because he'd never made that kind of movie before, and it was just an interesting bar to jump over for him.
Yeah. You know?
But he prided himself on being a jack of all trades. And there were certain genres, obviously, that he had more of an affinity for than others, but he didn't think of himself, I don't think, in the same league as John Ford or Howard Hawks.
No.
At all. Yeah, he, he was one of the few people in the Directors Guild Ford liked, it seems, and they liked each other.
Yeah.
You know, but again, it was not like they went on camping trips together or went drinking together. It was not that kind of a relationship. I think they just recognized each other as kindred spirits, and they could talk at a DGA meeting about the various problems and basically be on the same page.
And they could both feign contempt about how they felt about their art.
Yeah, well, I don't know that they thought of it as an art. I think Ford did. I just don't think he would ever cop to it.
Yeah.
I think Wellman would too, maybe for the best stuff he did. You know, he knew Wings was really good. You know, and he also knew Buffalo Bill wasn't. and he was his own worst critic, his own harshest critic. He had no illusions about what being a lengthy career in the movies entailed. It entailed compromise.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got lucky and you basically were able to make the movie you had in your head at the beginning, but other times, you know, you had to take casting that you weren't happy with, and you had to do things that you just weren't happy with, and that was because that's what you had to do to make the Oxbow Incident.
Yeah.
You know? And a lot of people didn't like the Oxbow Incident then, and a lot of people don't like the Oxbow Incident now. But it was the picture he wanted to make, and he made it the way he wanted to make it. So, for better or for worse, you can take that as one of the pictures that, that Wellman did as Wellman wanted to.
Sure. Yeah. And Ford was very much like that, too, in that he would think, okay, this one's for me, this one's for them.
Oh, you know, overtly.
And just...
Overtly.
I think you always had to be like that if you were a studio guy.
But he could. He also could contrive. I'm sure he would not have necessarily volunteered to direct Wee Willie Winkie.
Yeah.
But it happens to be a John Ford movie. You can't. You could watch the movie if you miss the credits, and you can tell it's a John Ford movie. Not
sure.
Just because of Victor McLaughlin, but because of this whole attention he pays to ceremony and death and mortality and all these things. It's very much a Ford movie, and that's a great gift where you can take basically an assignment. A job of work, and somehow converted to some sort of personal, if not work of art, but a personal work of craft.
Yeah. I think that's what all those guys were good at. I mean, Hawks is probably the one who made it look the most effortless, just that he just seemed to sail through because those films just seem so breezy, so... It's like Fred Astaire dancing. It just seems like anybody could do that.
Yeah,
right?
But you know, you don't see the 6 weeks of rehearsal that
Astaire
can
do. And it was the same with all those guys. They all had that. Let's distance ourselves from the effete artiste. You know.
Well, it's like with Wayne. You know, who always wanted to give the impression that he never wanted to be an actor. You know, just for this thing from his mind. He backed into it. It landed in his lap, and he ran with it. You know, which.
Yeah.
Totally false. I mean, he wanted to be an actor probably from the time he was 12 years old in Glendale watching Harry Carey movies or Bruno Valentino and the Four Horsemen. But he's a blue-collar kid, lower middle class. B, he's a jock. There's no way a lower middle class jock in the early 20th century is going to raise his hand and go, I'd like to be an actor, and go around and proclaim it because it's not a reputable profession.
Sure.
For a masculine, red-blooded guy, theoretically. You know, and I mean, practically to the end of the 20th century, a lot of people would be a little uncomfortable about, you know, confessing to ambitions about being an actor because it's not a job for an adult. It doesn't matter if it was William Holden or Errol Flynn. I mean, there's John Barrymore. The woods are full of those guys who really were a little bit embarrassed that they were so good at that business because they felt they should have been doing something more appropriate.
But here's the difference to me in Wayne and other guys we've been talking about is that Wellman, Ford, Hawks, all these guys spent their lives when they were making movies, they were off hunting and, you know, flying planes and racing cars and really making you know that they are not effete artistes.
It's called compensation.
Yeah. Whereas I always felt Wayne was secure enough in himself that he didn't really do that kind of stuff, or it doesn't seem to me that he did.
He'd go bird shooting once in a while with Bill Clothier, you know, but not on a regular basis. He didn't really have any hobbies. See, that was his problem, really.
Yeah.
His hobby was his profession. He really loved making movies, and there was nothing else he loved quite as much as making movies. Everything else was instead of a make good, as it were. And he, you know, he'd come back after making a film and say, oh, God, I'm so glad to be home. I'm so exhausted, blah, 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 blah. Let's go on the boat. So they'd go on the boat, and after a week or two, he'd start to get a little restless.
You know?
His capacity for relaxation was severely limited, you know.
Sure.
And he was a workaholic, basically. And as opposed to guys like, I don't think Wellman was a workaholic. I think Wellman, especially after he married Dorothy Coonan, I think he was perfectly happy to sit around at the house. Or he wouldn't have walked away in 1957 the way he did, when he was still eminently employable. You know, Ford was an alcoholic. He was a workaholic. I mean, he was a complicated guy. Nobody's ever going to get to the bottom of John Ford because he didn't want anybody getting to the bottom of John Ford. But Wayne was, I think it was Rod Taylor who told me he didn't have a football team he followed. Not really. I mean, he'd check and see how the Trojans were doing. He didn't really play golf much. Once in a great while, he'd go out. But he didn't really have anything else. in his life other than filmmaking, which ultimately is a problem, you know. And it got to the, and it broke up his last marriage because she wanted him to back off and relax a little bit, and because his health was breaking down, clearly. And he wouldn't do it. He just wouldn't do it because he just couldn't sit around the house and listen to his arteries harden.
Yeah. Well, what I like about your book so much is that it really does get at the heart of something that I think about Wayne a lot, and that is the incredible dichotomies in his personality. He was at once one thing and the opposite of that thing. He was the only other film person I can think of with that sort of puzzling dissonance is John Farrow, who I've always said everything you know about him, the opposite is equally true. And Wayne is kind of like that too, because he did say horrible racist things in that Playboy interview. And yet I've talked to lots of people, liberals and conservatives and everything in between, who knew him and worked with him, and I've never met anyone who didn't adore him. When Claire and I first moved out to California in 1992, most of who we knew were old commies. And so we would end up with, you know, at a Sunday afternoon dinner party with people 30 years older than us, and they were all blacklisted people, and, you know, Phil Stern and all these people, and Abe Polonsky and all these great people. And so one day I was talking with Phil Stern, because he was one of the primary still photographers on the Alamo. And I said, well, you're a liberal's liberal, Phil. You know, what did you think about Wayne? He said, oh, loved him. And everybody started gathering around, and they all said, yeah, he was terrific. And my friend Karen Morley said, well, here's the thing about Wayne, is that he didn't lie about who he was, that you knew exactly what he felt about anything, and therefore you could deal with him on his own terms. He wasn't a backstabber, he wasn't a liar, he wasn't a cheat. He believed what he believed, but he didn't punish you for believing otherwise. And so they all just loved him. Everybody in that room. And I thought, I bet people would not expect this to be true.
Well, what you're talking about is, for instance, the Playboy interview, where he's uttering these astonishingly, you know, well, racist statements. They're all abstractions. He's talking kind of, you know, in without taking the human element into account. And in his mind, that was one area. That's one thing. But it also, the personal always trumped the political. He always gave precedence to individuals over his blanket statements. So that's why he could be hit it off great with Orson Welles, who was extremely left. Or Haskell Wexler, for God's sake. You know, when I talked to Wexler...
Who's more liberal than Wexler?
Nobody's. He went, the guy who went to Hanoi with Jane Fonda. So, Wexler shot like four or five of those great Western commercials that he did at the end of his life, when basically it was the only income he had. And he needed the income.
Because he was uninsurable, right?
He couldn't get... They closed down the shooters for 2 weeks. Because he got a cold in Carson City, and it turned into a lung infection, and turned into bronchitis, and he couldn't get his breath. And he couldn't work. And he was really laboring. And they had to shut down for 2 weeks, and they weren't sure that he was ever going to come back, because he was in bad shape. It was a very difficult picture for him to make. It didn't have to be, but his condition, his physical condition was deteriorating. And they had to close down the picture for 2 weeks, which did not get out. It didn't get in the trades at all. But they still had to make an insurance claim on it and collect. And the fact that the picture basically was a break-even proposition, and it had to make an expensive insurance claim on it, mitigated against him getting a lot of offers. He got a few offers after that, but they were from people like Irwin Allen. You know, they weren't really A-list stuff. And he shied away from it, and he had trouble getting another picture off the ground of his own. So he started doing commercials for income, because he was a terrible businessman. He was one of the world's worst businessmen. Because he wanted to work with his pals and drinking buddies, which is, you can't do that, not in in business. And Wexler was shooting and directing these commercials, and they're nice commercials, they're really good. But I figured there had to be a hammer and tongs. But no, you know, Wayne would have, you know, make some snotty remark about female grips. because Webster always made it a point to have women on the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And Wayne would get pissy because he thought they were taking jobs away from men who couldn't support their families because the women were taking the jobs. You know, it's kind of a neat thing. But once he got to know the women, he would apologize and, you know, fall all over himself trying to make good, you know, on the offense. Because the personal trumped the political for him. He didn't make the mistake of erecting walls over ideology. He had ideology, but people always took precedence over theory in his life. That's why he could work so effectively with so many very far left people, and who remembered him and enjoyed the experience of working with him and remembered him with great affection.
Yeah, I've yet to come across anybody who had another reaction to him, at least professionally.
Well, he was essentially a very gregarious person.
Yeah.
He liked people. He really liked people. And as a result, people basically really liked him. It was a transference of affection, you know. He didn't have that standoffish actor's thing. Well, please don't touch me. You know, don't ask me for my autograph. I'm an artiste.
Yeah.
Thing. I mean, he figured he literally saw his audience as extended family, which is why in his own productions, after the initial ambitiousness of the Wayne Fellows productions in the 50s at Warner's, where they really were doing some interesting things, and they weren't making any money, he basically Bat Jack settled into a niche where they made John Wayne movies the way the audience wanted to see John Wayne movies. And for the experimental stuff, for the stuff that would push him into areas like The Searchers or even Liberty Valance, those would have to go out to John. He would be working for John Ford or Hawks or something like that, who would draw colors out of him that he wouldn't ask of Andy McLaughlin or Burt Kennedy. But he literally thought of his audience as extended family. And as he explained it to me, if you invite people to your house, you don't give them food and drink that they don't like. You know, you want to make them comfortable.
Sure.
You want to make them, you know, feel at home. So you give them what they want to have, and you meet them on their level. Not necessarily you don't force them to meet you on your level, which is what he thought of as the so that when, in the pictures he was making and producing, he was making pictures that he believed the way he thought the audience wanted to see them.
Yeah.
Whereas Ford couldn't give less of a damn about what the audience wanted. Ford was going to make what Ford wanted.
Sure.
You know, and Hawks, too, to a great extent.
Well, how do you think that ties in with Wayne's conscious construction of a character of who, not that he played the same character in every role, because, of course, he had a broad range of what he did, but there were certain standards beyond which he would not go. And do you think that was part of it, that he wanted to establish a trust with the audience that he would not give them something that they wouldn't like about himself?
No, he would do that. But he would need to be nudged into that place. He would need to be nudged. He would need to feel secure about it. He would need to trust that guy who was asking him to do that absolutely. And there weren't that many people he trusted absolutely, really.
Sure.
And we all know their names. Left to his own devices, he tended to play it down the middle of the fairway. That's all.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to try to get to the green in one. To belabor the golf metaphor, he was going to, you know, put one down the middle of the fairway, 225, hit a 6-iron, 2-putt. You know, that was what he saw the Bat Jack pictures was doing.
Yeah.
If Pappy wanted him to play this crazed racist in the middle of Monument Valley for 8 weeks, okay.
Yeah.
He'd do it, because he never said no to John Ford, because experience had taught him that it wasn't wise to say no to John Ford, because John Ford was smarter than he was, and John Ford knew more than he did, and he knew that.
Yeah.
He was a very Wayne was a self-aware guy. He didn't have a lot of blind alleys. He had blind alleys ideologically, where his entire political philosophy was essentially predicated on self-reliance. And if he'd brought himself up from poverty, near poverty, lower middle class life, at best lower middle class, to a multimillionaire on paper, and worldwide fame, why couldn't everybody else do the same thing in their field? He didn't understand that. And as Kate Hepburn said, he's got this powerful locomotive. He had a huge desire and focus and intensity.
Yeah.
He was going to be successful in any business he was in. I really believe that. If he'd stayed in law school, he'd have been he would have been you know, a judge in the Supreme Court someplace in California, or Nevada or Arizona. But he was going to be a success because nobody else in his family was, and he was the designated caretaker, and he was going to do it. He just was, and Ford happened to be the key, you know, who gave him the boost. I don't know that he would have been as big a star. I don't know that his career would have ascended to the heights it did if it hadn't been for Ford. I think you can make a case that if you take away the Ford pictures and if you take away the Hawks pictures, his filmography and the Hathaway pictures, those three guys, his filmography is much less interesting.
Sure it is. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that he's John Wayne without those 15 or 16 Ford pictures and Red River. I mean, that's...
Yeah, those are the pictures that show how far he could go,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and how talented he was. Mm-hmm. And
how good an actor he was.
Yeah.
I mean, that he could do She Wore Yellow Ribbon and Red River within a year of each other, and Three Godfathers, bang, 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 like that. Now, Three Godfathers is more of a conventional John Wayne. It's like it's the same character he basically plays in The Stagecoach, the good outlaw.
Sure.
But She Wore Yellow Ribbon and Red River are 180 degrees away from each other. I mean, those are really, that's an exhibition of acting range. And they're both totally convincing.
Well, I always think of Long Voyage Home, too. Completely apart from the Swedish accent,
mm-hmm,
which is pretty creditable for
okay,
for what it is.
It's okay.
It's fine. But more to the point is that it's this sweet,
mm-hmm,
interior character,
mm-hmm,
of the without kind that he really did not
body,
do.
Without a mean,
yeah,
bone in his body.
It's really a very much different from what we would normally, mm-hmm, assume. And it also is one of those things that shows you what he could do.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I
think the crucial conversation was that thing I write about with Harry and Ollie Carey, where they were on the Shepherd of the Hills, I think. And he was talking, he was full of himself after Stagecoach, and he could feel the momentum building because he was suddenly getting A-list pictures for major studios and Technicolor and all these things, you know, after,
sure,
20 years in the wilderness. And he was talking about he wanted to do this and to play this kind of part and play that kind of part. And Ollie said, "You dumb son of a bitch." He said, "Excuse me?" He said, "There's Harry standing over there. Do you want to see Harry be anything other than Harry Carey?" He said, "Well, of course not." She said, "Okay, be like Harry. That's what the people want you to be. They want you to be like Duke. Be like Harry. Be yourself."
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think it was a light bulb went on over his head, but I think it was probably a very important conversation in his life, you know, because if you think about it, left to his own devices, he was like Harry, you know, he, within his own personality range and his own comfort level. And if Ford, you know, rang him up and said, "Okay, pal, it's time to go to work," he didn't even ask. He just did what he was told.
Sure.
You know? And I think Ollie Carey read him the Riot Act, basically, and it stuck with him.
Yeah, I think it's tempting and maybe a little bit condescending of, I would just say, me, to look at what his acting career could have been if he had thrown off the shackles of what he believed that basic character could be. Because I think he could have done remarkable things.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been great on stage, I think. He could have done many great things.
Mm-hmm.
But that's disingenuous to say because he was one of the most popular movie stars, mm-hmm, in history and continues to be.
Mm-hmm.
So what the hell do I know?
And that's unusual in and of itself. Because let's,
yeah,
face it, most movie stars are only movie stars for their generation. And then they gradually recede. I mean, when he became a star, Clark Gable was huge. Tyrone Power was huge. Gary Cooper was huge. They were all much more important than he was. And continued to be for a long time. You don't hear a lot of talk about Tyrone Power anymore. And, you know, you don't hear a lot of talk even about Gary Cooper anymore.
Yeah.
And Gable's remembered for two movies. It Happened One Night and Gone with the Wind. That's it. And I think, actually, that's the difference. It's a question of did you make important work? Did you do important work? Does the work last? And Gable's a great star, but he was a company man at MGM, and he did what he was told, and they weren't making really good pictures for him. They were just vehicles. And he was obediently making vehicles. Wayne was lucky in that, you know, he latched on to Ford, and he latched onto Hawks, and they stuck with him. And those were not vehicles. Those are great pictures. And people are still arguing about them 60 and 70 years
later,
and talking about them, and trying to get to the bottom of them. And they never will, because they're that dense and that deep.
Yeah.
Well, some of them. Ford Apache certainly is that deep.
Yeah.
And Liberty Valance is that deep. And the Searchers is that deep. I'm not going to say Donovan's Reef is that deep.
It's an awful lot of fun, though.
It is fun.
I want to backtrack a little bit just about you, because we were talking a little bit about how you got started, but what's the genesis of your interest in film? How far back does that go?
Since I can remember. I can remember throwing a tantrum to get my grandmother to take me to see Harold Lloyd's World of Comedy. I was 11.
Mm-hmm.
And it was playing in what they used to refer to as a changing neighborhood. Continental Art Theater in Cleveland, Ohio. It was black neighborhood, basically. And she was terrified she'd never see me again if I went to this movie. So I just threw a fit. And not literally a fit, but I just made her life hell. And she finally said, all right. So she dropped me off the theater, and she waited outside for 2 hours until the movie was over, so I wouldn't have to risk my life by walking any further than under the marquee.
But she just couldn't bring herself to watch the movie herself.
No, she had no interest. She had grown up with those fit with Harold Lloyd, but she just couldn't have cared less.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just love silent movies and the, you know, fractured flickers. And we had the Robert Youngson pictures, of course. I saw those, and I just inhaled this stuff. And I started buying Black Hawk 8mm stuff when I was 12.
Well, how did you even become aware that silent pictures existed?
Television. In the 50s and early 60s, you could still see silent movies. Laurel and Hardy were on TV all the time. Cleveland, I grew up in Cleveland. Cleveland had a good TV packages. You had, the great Universal Monster movie packages. But you also had all the W.C. Fields movies on.
Sure.
You know, we had good, not so much MGM, but we had great Paramount stuff. So you saw all the great Paramount stuff in pretty decent 16mm prints. And they had these things for decades. I was still watching the same prints at 28 that I'd been watching at 10, you know. But we had a pretty good environment in Cleveland on television. And then along came a revival theater that started playing 35mm stuff, where I wangled a job, you know. And that I got to see all the movies for free, which was, I would have paid cash money to do. I don't know. It's just, you know, why do you see one girl across the room and say, oh, and the one that's standing next to her does nothing for you? Your sure. eye just goes to that one girl. Why did my eye go to silent movies? I don't know. It just did. But it was, I think people that are drawn to art on a kind of compulsive, immersive level are generally speaking, trying to escape from reality. Really. You know, I think the world around them is somehow failing them. So they go into, you know, the imaginary world of literature, or the imaginary world of film, or what have you, Etruscan poetry. You know, it depends on what brings your bell. In my case, it was a wretched childhood, you know, and I didn't want to be around the house. So if MGM would send out a reissue double bill of The Great Caruso and Showboat, I wanted to be there, because it was 4 hours away from the house. Even if the only people there were, you know, hobbling on canes.
Sure.
You know, because we didn't have the MGM pictures in Cleveland. There was no way to see those on television.
Yeah.
So this was like, or the Garbo pictures would occasionally show up, or the W.C. Fields movies would occasionally show, the Universals would occasionally show up in reissue stuff, and Marx Brothers and all that. So it was a means of escape. It was a means of escape.
Well, when did you start thinking you wanted to write about them?
18, 16, 17. I always knew I could write a little. I had a natural affinity for writing. I was writing in high school. I haven't looked at it in a long time, nor do I want to, you know. But I started publishing in The Plain Dealer in Cleveland when I was 20, 21, you know. They were doing like kind of semi-feature stories. I wrote a piece for Chaplin's 80th birthday, I remember, that ran on a cover. So I figured I must have some affinity for it. I must have some skill to be able to do this at my age. The problem was I didn't know how to get to the promised land, which was books and financial independence. How do you make a living doing this? So I thought, well, scripts. Let's write movie scripts. Well, the least exposure to California in the movie industry teaches you that writers are, you know, have no power and no leverage whatsoever, really. And what I needed emotionally and psychologically was leverage and control over my own life. And I couldn't go from a situation where I had no control over my own life to another situation where I really had no control over my own life. That was a recipe for alcoholism. So I thought I would write, you know, write stuff about classical period movies. But I didn't know how to monetize. There's that ugly word that was coined like 20 years ago. I didn't know how to monetize. And it took me a long time to figure it out. Like last year.
Well, better late than never.
Exactly.
I'm still working on that. Your books, I don't know if they've all been uniformly successful, but they've all done pretty well.
They've all done critically successful. Yeah. They've all been critically successful. I've had a few that dropped dead commercially.
But everybody
has books that drop
sure.
dead, especially in nonfiction. Especially nonfiction, because if you write nonfiction, unless you're just going to specialize in the Civil War, you know, where you know there's a certain level of advance and there's a certain level of sales that you know you can get 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 copies, whatever it is. But cultural history and pop history and movies, there's you know, it can go up, down, up, down. There's no such thing as an extensive sure thing.
But you have written books that, on the surface, would seem to have very limited commercial possibilities.
I have, and did in fact have limited commercial possibilities.
Like the biography of Lubitsch, which exactly. is terrific.
5,000 copies. 5,000 copies. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did it.
And the sound book, the Dawn of Sound.
About the same.
The Speed of Sound.
About the same, 5,000 copies.
Yeah. Now, didn't you tell me long ago that you had to kind of finagle to get that one published?
Speed of Sound was piggyback to the John Ford biography.
Ah.
Because it was, I tend to write books I want to read, really want to read, which presupposes that no one else has written them. So you're filling in gaps in the wall. Excuse me. You're filling in gaps that people, for one reason or another, because you couldn't make a dime doing it, or they tried to do it and they botched it. You know, whatever the case may be. But I really wanted to read a good book about the coming of sound, and no, I didn't think Walker's book was okay. Alexander Walker's book was mm-hmm. okay, but it left me with more questions than it answered, and there really wasn't anything else. So I just sort of nominated myself, and I barely got it in under the wire. You know, the Ford was the locomotive pulling that train, but it was a two-book deal. But I already started work on the sound book, so I did the sound book first, but the Ford book was the one that they really wanted. That was the only time I've actually done that. That was the only time I had a two-book deal, which I don't recommend. It was because
sure.
Do you really want to know where you're going to be, what you're going to be doing in 4 years, you know, and what you're going to be writing in 4 years? It really closes off, you know, taking certain kinds of vacations, for instance, because you know you're going to have to go to Monument Valley, or you're going to have to do this, or you're going to have to do that. You know, and it was very kind of oppressive, I found, to do it for a two-book deal, because it was just too long a commitment.
Well, speaking of Monument Valley, and this is a tangent, but didn't you find a dog there?
Yes, I did. Well, not directly.
I don't know this story at all. I've seen the pictures.
Yeah, so. this is about Clementine. My wife and I volunteered at Best Friends Animal Sanctuary last year. Was it last year? The year before, 2 years ago, which we'd always wanted to do. We're members, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we made the journey out to Moab. My wife likes to go to Las Vegas, and I can tolerate it. So we spent some time in Vegas, and then we drove to Can-Am, where Best Friends is located. I'd never been to Can-Am or Moab. Very beautiful country, and we enjoyed our time in Ken Abbott, Best Friends. And I was working with, and you know, you volunteer, and they put you kind of where you want to be, what you have an affinity for, you know, parrots, cats, overweight cats, dying cats,
sure.
dying dogs, feral dogs, whatever you want, you know, they'll put you, that's where you work. So they put us with puppies, and it was a motley crew. But there was this one dog that my eye went to, sandy-colored, fuzzy-faced, and she would get in the puppy scrum and roll around and, you know, yip-yap, yip-yap, and then she'd suddenly stop and go jump on a chair and watch. Just watch. And then she'd watch for a minute or 90 seconds, and then she'd jump back down and get in the scrum again with the other puppies. And then again, she'd stop and walk away and turn around and just watch the other dogs. And I thought, that's a good dog for a writer. Because you're in the scrum, but you're not. You're basically watching people. Mm-hmm. You're basically an observer. So I asked about her, and she'd been found in a box along with five of her siblings on the Navajo Reservation in Monument Valley. I said, you're not serious. Monument Valley. She said, yeah, Monument Valley. I said, I'm taking the dog. And it wasn't that easy because another couple had an interest in the dog. But the adoption counselor, we had a fenced-in yard, and we had two other dogs, and she'd have, like, a pack, et cetera, et cetera. So we ended up getting the dog, and I named her Clementine. Clemmy, for short. And
I do like that name.
She's the love of my life. It is a pretty. It sure is a pretty name, isn't it?
So, well, that's great. That's a perfect place to get a dog, isn't it?
It is. It is. And then I hadn't been to Monument Valley in 12 years, probably. And then CBS called me 2 months ago to go out there for CBS Sunday Morning for a story. And it was fascinating because, again, I hadn't been there in a long time since I did the John Ford book, which came out in 99.
Yeah.
And I asked one of the Navajos who was taking us around, how many people come out here now? He said, 470,000, 490,000 a year.
Wow.
And I said, how many of them are Americans? How many of them are Europeans? He said, it's like 40, 60, 30, 70 American to European, mostly Europeans and Chinese and Japanese. So it's like there's no reason to go to Monument Valley except that you've seen it in a John Ford picture, you know, or maybe the Leonis once upon a time in the West. I can't imagine too many people go to Monument Valley because they saw it in The Lone Ranger. And I just, it's a fascinating testimonial to the power of those images that Ford created. And also the sense that Westerns have become like jazz, that they're honored overseas. And nobody pays much attention here. They're like, Westerns, what's that? That's silly.
Yeah.
You know, guys on horses? Man, who wants to see that? But over there, they're still honored and respected.
Yeah, every once in a while somebody will still make a Western, and every time they do, you'll have the predictable round of articles saying, is the Western back? Mm-hmm. No, it's not.
And
it's
no.
Not.
And the answer, for 30 years, the answer has been, not a chance. No, those are vanity Westerns that someone with a great deal of power or clout wants to do a Western, whether it's Quentin Tarantino, and that was a terrible picture, or Seth MacFarlane, stuff like that. No, there hasn't. There's the Western is, for whatever reason, and it takes a far greater intelligence than mine to come up with reasons to why the Western died out. But the Western died out.
I was talking with someone else who had an interesting theory about that, and that is that from at least the 60s on, every Western was about the death of the West. And probably there's just, it became impossible for people to think of the West in any other way except as a dying entity. And I don't know if that's actually a theory or not, but it's, but there's something to that. I
the mean, audience lost, the, yeah, but the audience turned away though.
Yeah.
The audience got disinterested and then actively hostile.
Yeah. Well, with rare exceptions, audiences today seem to have only contempt for the past in any way.
True.
And rare occasions, I mean, Titanic certainly is the exception to that rule. Mm-hmm. They seem to revel in that, not only the ship, but also the period. But that's,
that's old guy talk, Frank.
That's not something that
we don't
happens,
want to sound like old guys. Even if it happens to be biologically true, you know, you don't want to fall into that. You kids get off my lawn, or I'll hit you with my cane.
No, I'm not doing that at all. I at least I hope I'm not doing it. It's just period things don't seem to gain a foothold in the culture, and I'm not quite sure why that is, because in my own life. Not only in my own youth, but in my own everything, the movies have always been a way to go someplace else, to go to a different time, to time travel, to travel around the world, to go into outer space, to wherever. And I don't understand a point of view that says, no, I only want to live in my own in my own life, in my own time, and nothing else interests me.
Well, the ironic thing is that it's never been easier to be knowledgeable about the past, because there's so much stuff on YouTube, there's so much stuff accessible, streaming, whatever stuff. I had to go to Berlin, literally. I had to go across the world to see. When I did Lubitsch book, I had to go to Berlin. The Ford book, I had to go to Paris. You know, you to see the films, you had to go all over the world. There was a real Lewis and Clark adventure aspect to it. And now...
And when you saw them, that was your chance.
Now, the stuff's there. All you got to do is press a button or get a DVD or, you know, stream it or whatever it might be. But the stuff's there. And the ease with which it's accessible seems to have had the contraindicated response, in that fewer people actually seem to be interested because it's so accessible.
Yeah.
You know, because the labor of going to see it was seemed to have been part of the attraction.
Well, it certainly draws it deeper into ourselves.
True.
If we have to really work to get something. And I have a million stories, I'm sure you do too, of having to travel long distances and going in and watching something and then right back out the door and long distances back home, you know. And that's just the way it was. My Wellman book, it took me, 10 different cities to see those films. And that came out in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the Iron Age. It was.
And 30 years later, would you even have to leave the house?
No. I could see literally every existing Wellman film in my home.
Right.
No
exactly.
problem.
Exactly.
And more and more, even the documents that we had to work so hard for are showing up.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all showing up, but you know, I'm sure you've seen David Pierce's
mm-hmm.
page of film magazines,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
a million pages,
mm-hmm.
completely searchable.
Mm-hmm.
This is I can sit in my house and do something that would have taken me weeks of travel to,
sure.
to find these things.
Or a great deal of money spent buying
yeah.
copies.
Buying copies or going through microfilm.
Right.
And now you put in the search and, mm-hmm. and there it is.
Thanks.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, I mean, your point is well taken. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. It is what it is. Life is how it is. But I don't think that you do have the same reverence for something if it's just handed to you.
Probably. It's probably a psychological switch
yeah.
in the head. The longer the girl holds out, the more valuable the experience will be.
Exactly. that's hard for you to believe in at the time.
I don't believe it. I think the girls believe it. I don't know that I believe it. I don't know that any man really believes it.
I want to talk a little bit about the Lubitsch book, because that was an interesting book and nobody had really dealt with him
mm-hmm.
at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a long time since I read that book. When did it come out? That must have been the mid-90s?
93 or 94.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, wow, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. That was totally, I think I had more fun writing that book than I think anything I've written. If I were to do it over, it would probably be 50 pages longer. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think I'd go deeper into the films. I don't think I'd go deeper into him, because I think I got him, and I think the research. I mean, I talked to everybody that was alive who knew him, people that I wasn't even sure existed,
yeah.
but they might be below ground. But I would go deeper into some of the films. I don't know that the book would be better, but I think it would be at least 30 or 40, 50 pages longer.
How did you choose him? Sorry.
Oh, because in researching the Pickford book, I saw Rosita.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Museum of Modern Art. Again, my earlier point about going, you know, I had to go to New York to see it, and they had that, I think it's Russian subtitles. But the plot is, you know, easily apprehendable. And I sat there watching Rosita thinking, so what's the problem here? This is actually very good. Why'd she hate this movie? You know, what was the, and it started, I just started asking myself questions about Lubitsch and all these other, it was like a domino thing, where why'd she hate this movie, which related to Pickford. And that led to why did Lubitsch agree to direct this movie, as opposed to the film he actually came over to do, and that started me thinking about Lubitsch, and then I realized that I had all these questions about Lubitsch that I couldn't be answered because nobody had written a book on Lubitsch other than the Herman Weinberg thing, which is basically a compilation, like a Robert Youngson kind of book. So I nominated myself. But it was a great experience. And I mean, I didn't make any money on it, but that was okay because I had fun and I got to meet. The thing about Lubitsch is, what's the shrink's phrase? He was a totally he was a totally actualized person. He was absolutely the person he wanted to be. He didn't have a lot of internal conflicts. He liked being who he was. And because he had that kind of personality, that essentially sunny personality, he attracted other people like that. So talking to all those survivors of the Berlin Hollywood axis was fascinating because they were just people that you didn't meet in Cleveland, Ohio, or West Palm Beach, Florida.
Sure.
You know, I remember Walter Lemley, you know, had a carpet store on La Cienega. And he talked about directing two real westerns at Universal, you know, and he was a riot. And, you know, Lubitsch's doctor. Whoever thought you'd find Lubitsch's doctor? Who's still practicing? Who was still practicing?
Wow.
And he told me all about him, you know, all about his medical condition and how he dealt with it and his fear and all this. But and people like the Weilers, Tally Weiler. William Weiler was dead by that time. But Tally was alive, and she was still living in the house in Malibu that the Weilers had, where I'd interviewed William Weiler 10 or 12 years earlier. And she was still living there by herself, and she was. I realized why that marriage had worked, just spending, you know, a couple hours with her, because she was so relaxed and loving and warm, and she's exactly the kind of person that a non-neurotic director would want to be with, because he's dealing with crazy neurotics like Bette Davis and Sam Goldwyn all day long. He doesn't want to come home and deal with someone
sure.
like that. So he married someone with a totally opposite personality, which is why the marriage worked.
Sure.
You know. But they were all a pleasure to spend time with.
She was Dottie Kunin.
There was no downside to talking to those people. And there was really no downside to dealing with Ernst Lubitsch. Because, other than his lousy health, and which killed him, and his bad taste in women, there was really no downside to his personality either. He was just a very benign, pleasant guy to be with, which is not always the case when you do a biography. You know, sometimes you have to wrestle with really difficult people.
Well, that's certainly the case with Ford.
Sure, that was a six-year job.
Yeah,
and it was unquestionably the most difficult of my books, because against the greatness of his work, you had to deal with the squalor of his private life. And the terrible alcoholism and the damage that was inflicted in any alcoholic household, the damage that's inflicted on the other people.
He's a guy that's still so difficult for me to figure out, because the movies, by and large, are so beautiful and so lyrical and so gentle and so filled with insight and compassion, and you don't feel like there's any of that in the man himself. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, but it had to have been.
Sure, absolutely.
But he spent his entire life building a wall up or masking it in some way.
I think Darcy O'Brien was right when he told me that, you know, what he was like in private with his wife, who knows, you know, she probably knew him or better than anybody did. But I think Darcy was right when he said, I think John Ford was his films. I think that was it. I don't think there was much left over once for anybody else. And that's always the question of an artist. You know, the artist always puts his primary energies into the work. And the family and the friends and everything, the social life, has to deal with what's left. And in Ford's case, there wasn't much left. You know, I mean, there were times, you know, they'd go on the boat and they'd read books, and he'd stay sober, and, you know, they just wouldn't talk much, and they just enjoy the outdoors and the sun and the fish and all that. And there were other times when he was just very destructive and very self-destructive, and people put up with it. People cleaned up after him, literally. But I think Ford was his film. Certainly the best part of Ford was his films.
Well, you can speak to Wayne specifically, but I would think we'd need to ask ourselves this about a lot of actors who worked with him, because people seem to worship him. And Wayne, to read most of the anecdotes, he was just abused by Ford constantly, yet he followed him around like a dog his entire life and did everything he wanted Ford asked him to do. And I think that was the case with a lot of people who really, I mean, Maureen O'Hara.
Well, you remember that thing at the end of the book that where she breaks in this monologue?
Yeah.
You know, where she said if Ford walked in the door today and said, let's go, should I go right out the door and follow him? Because he was the best. And everything that followed from that. Because you had a chance at something great. And if you're working in the movie business, in the show business, it's mostly product. And you know going in, it's mostly product. But there are certain people where you've got a shot at something that people look at 50 years down the road. And that's why people put up with Stanley Kubrick wanting 50 takes and then recasting the part. Or John Ford abusing people. And Ford and Wayne had this weird binary relationship. I call it a binary relationship because it really had, publicly, Ford gave him nothing but grief. You know, in front of other people, it was, you big fairy. Why don't you walk like a man? Stop with the fairy walk. And, you know, it's a shame you couldn't serve in World War II either. You know, that just merciless abuse. Privately, when you read through the correspondence, it's a much more conventionally father-son relationship. And he's much more affectionate, openly affectionate, on paper, than he ever could be verbally. And again, I think he needed to be shielded. He couldn't express emotion openly. Ford could express emotion indirectly through a camera, through a letter, but I don't think he could sit down opposite somebody else and say, I love you.
Yeah.
I think that was the thing. He couldn't say to Wayne, I love you. You're like a son to me. But in the letters, it almost comes to that point, you know, where it's a very conventional father-son, supportive, affectionate relationship. But directly, he could not do it. And luckily, Wayne didn't need to have the words said that you're like a son to me. He didn't need that because on some level he understood. He understood the relationship because he had this father who had said these things to him and it didn't do a damn bit of good because the father couldn't even put the food on the table.
Sure.
He was a total feckless loser in spite of his well-meaning, the fact that he was emotionally accessible and all these other things. So for Wayne, the emotional accessibility was not necessarily part of the deal. What was part of the deal was the real thing. Not just the words, not just the conversation, the real thing that went on, the results. Did Ford take care of him? Absolutely. He took care of him as an actor. He shielded him as an actor. He built beautiful structures around Wayne as an actor so that Wayne could shine. Did he take good care of him commercially? Absolutely. He did all the things a father director could do to a son actor, really.
Sure.
Except express it verbally. That he could not do, and that he could never do.
Yeah, and would do just the opposite. I mean, as far as the world could see, he just treated him with total contempt. It's always been very interesting to me because everybody's got stories about how Ford would come down on one person and just destroy them.
And it wasn't a conventional bullying thing, because if you came back at him, then you were really in trouble. Then he wouldn't speak to you at all. It was like you died, you know, and he wouldn't even deal with you. You stand over there, and that would be the extent of your direction,
yeah.
You know, and suddenly you were like you were like a zombie in the middle of all these living people, if you actually came back at him. See, most bullies will immediately back off if you go at him. But he wasn't a conventional bully. It was much more complicated than that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was much more complicated than that. So Wayne's response was probably the correct response, given the alternative.
Yeah. And certainly, as you said earlier, take those Ford films out of the Wayne canon, and what do you got left?
Am I writing this book?
Yeah.
In 2014? Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Because I think he would have been a perfectly good, you know, Wellman... in several interviews, maybe even the interview with you, I'm trying to remember. He talked about how distressed he was that Wayne didn't consider High and the Mighty to be one of his best films.
It wasn't mine.
And, but it's not, you know, and Wayne gives one of those, it's a perfectly fine performance. Yeah, There's nothing wrong with it.
There's nothing he could have done other than what he did.
Yeah.
It's the writing.
But it's not, yeah, it doesn't demand
now,
anything.
Island in the Sky is a much better movie. Yeah. Much better movie. And did Wellman have a big, passionate thing for Island in the Sky? Or did he think of it as his job of work?
I think it was only because of the flying thing that he had interest in it, but beyond that, he doesn't seem to
I didn't get the sense that there was a huge connection to it. It's a much better movie than High and the Mighty.
Sure it is.
I think Wellman saw High and the Mighty as a mortgage lifter because it was such a huge hit. It was one of those movies that everybody goes to see and everybody likes, and he had a piece of the profits. So it was very important in terms of his career because it really perked him up at a point where he wasn't doing a lot. The MGM period, except for Battleground, had ended badly.
Yeah.
A couple pictures no one saw. You know, he's getting older, and it's always dangerous when a director starts to get edged towards 60 with a couple of flops.
Sure.
Because there was no HBO to go bide your time in. This was it. And you didn't want to go to work at Allied Artists if you could help it. So a big smash like High and the Mighty, you know, he could have worked for a lot longer than he did. Like I said, he walked away out of choice, not of necessity. But it's not that good a picture, really, once you see it.
It's
Island in the Sky is a much better movie.
Island in the Sky is pretty good, and it's got a real sense of place to it. Mm-hmm. It's got some real jeopardy. Mm-hmm. That you feel that you don't feel at all in High and the Mighty, or at least I don't. Possibly because those flashbacks keep breaking the mood every time they come up. And if they just found a way to tell that story without doing all that, I think they would have built up a real... Yeah.
Also, it's interesting in terms of the Wayne character, because he's clearly terrified in Island in the Sky, but the reason he doesn't express it is because it would communicate, it would spread amongst the other guys, and he cannot do that, because he's got to pretend to a feeling of confidence that he doesn't actually have.
Sure.
Doesn't have anywhere near the level of confidence that he's got to pretend to. And that's an interesting tension for the performance. And he pulls it off beautifully.
Yeah. So we should probably wrap up. I know you got a lot more talking to do over the weekend. But let me ask you the basic question. How did you decide to come to Wayne? Certainly, there have been many books about him, and I wouldn't say there have been any great books about him, but there have been many. So, did you come to him thinking that there was something essential to his story that hadn't been told?
I came to him for essentially the same reason I came to Lubitsch. I had all these questions about him that no one had answered, because the books were not very good, frankly. And what I found most irritating was that in the 35 years since he died, he's really dead. After 35 years, you're dead. That he'd come to be viewed almost completely in ideological terms. That if a conservative was writing about John Wayne, then John Wayne was the risen Christ. If a liberal was writing about John Wayne, he was a draft-dodging, warmongering hypocrite. And it really didn't go much beyond that. So I wanted to approach him. I wanted to take the ideology out of it. Not that I don't deal with his politics and the Motion Picture Alliance and all that thing.
Sure.
There's a lot of new stuff about that. But I wanted to approach him not as a strictly political animal, because he wasn't a strictly political animal. I wanted to approach him as a producer, as a director, as a co-worker, as a father, as a grandfather, as an actor. What a concept to approach John Wayne as an actor. And as an ideological person, but I didn't want to impose an ideological bias on all those other parts of his being. And because I'd spent some time with him, and this was actually the crucial thing, the guy I spent that time with, I could not find in the books at all, at any point.
Sure.
Occasionally there'd be an anecdote where you'd say, yeah, that was him. But I just didn't see him. I had this interesting experience. This is about 15 years ago. It's before, just before I did the Ford book. There was a biography published of a guy I knew very well. who had died, and it was done by a respectable writer. And I was anxious to read it because I'd known this guy, and we'd gone out to lunch together, and we'd drunk together, and he told me stories and this, that, and the other thing. So the book comes out, and I read it, and that guy was not in that book. It wasn't that the book was relentlessly negative. It was that you couldn't smell his aftershave. You didn't know what he ate. You didn't get a sense of his dailiness, what he wore. You know, there was no sense of how he lived his life. And like I think I mentioned in the book, everything in it was accurate, but nothing was true.
Sure.
So this affected my writing of the Ford book. It wasn't enough to get it accurate. I wanted the reader to get a sense of John Ford in the room. What he looked like, how he talked, what he sounded like. All these things that, you know. And the same thing with Wayne. In the books that have been written about him, whether it was that surly thing Gary Wills wrote, you know, liberal take, he's a warmongering, draft-dodging hypocrite, or the conservative take, I wanted the reader to know what he was like in the room. What he was like to talk to, you know, what he was like to work with, the dailiness of him. That's what I wanted. And nobody had done that. Nobody had done that. I can say that with absolute confidence. Nobody had done that. And that's something that I taught myself to do. Now, I had a leg up because I'd met him. I'd spent 90 minutes with him. I'd watched him work on The Shootist. So I'd seen him work, and I'd seen him relaxing. And it's been in both those environments. So I had a definite leg up. It wasn't done for any commercial reason. I'm stunned at the commercial response. Stunned. Really. It's not anything I expected. I knew he was a prevailing part of the American fabric, but I underestimated the extent to which he is a part of the American fabric. That is a surprise.
I think he's still widely beloved, but also widely controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good combination, I guess, for getting people interested in reading more about him.
I guess. I never expected the New York Times bestseller list, you know. I never expected 6 printings in 2 weeks. That's just off the charts
stuff.
Astonishing. It's off the charts stuff. And it's a tribute to him, really. I mean, it also has taught me that execution is, I mean, I've executed books every bit as well as I've executed this book. And they didn't sell this well. So execution has to be matched to subject.
Sure.
You can execute. I remember talking to Billy Wilder in his office at Universal. And he was so philosophical about the Spirit of St. Louis, which I believe was the greatest financial disaster in the history of Warner Brothers up to that time. I think Camelot obliterated it, but, you know. But as of 1957, it was the biggest flop in the history of Warner Brothers. And it's a beautiful picture.
Yeah.
It's not a Billy Wilder picture, but he executes it perfectly. But he talked about you don't know. He said I couldn't make that, something effective, I couldn't make that movie any better than I did. He said, and it dropped like a stone into the Grand Canyon, and it hasn't been heard from since. He said, other pictures, you work just as hard on the flops as you do on the successes. He said, other pictures, I guarantee you, I worked every bit as hard on that picture as I did on Sunset Boulevard or Double Indemnity or The Apartment. He said, you don't know. It's a question of subject matter, not just execution. And he executed Spirit of St. Louis beautifully. Nobody wanted to see the movie.
Yeah.
They just didn't want that story. They wanted the story of John Wayne. I can't explain it, but they do.
Well, it's a terrific book, and it is worth mentioning that not only is it on the New York Times bestseller list, or is about to be, as we record this, but the book that you co-wrote with Robert Wagner, mm-hmm. is on the New York Times bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
So you ain't doing too bad.
It's been 2014's a good year.
So far.
You know, I got no complaints. I got no complaints.
You can only get better.
I don't know about that. See, you know, somebody said, it was David Thompson. I asked David Thompson, what did I do right, David? And he said, you stayed true to yourself and you waited for fate to come to you. Which is a very Thompsonian
sure it is.
Remark. And I pride myself on maybe hoping it's true, because you do want to stay true to yourself. And he said, and you were also lucky. He said, and you'll find that out in the next book. And I told him, I said, David, this is never going to happen again. And it doesn't have to. Because it happened once.
Sure.
And that's enough. And if it's something, two bestsellers in 1 year for any writer, don't get greedy. Just let it go and enjoy it.
You're not going to try for three next year?
No.
Well, speaking of which, do you have another subject in the works, or are you just still...
I've got some ideas, but I haven't started anything. I've got three or four ideas, and I haven't settled, actually. And I don't know if I should try to follow up Wayne or just go off on my own and still stay true to myself, as David Thompson would say. I suspect I'll stay true to myself because I'm too old not to.
Well,
I don't know who else to be true to.
You could go from this to the Ward Bond biography.
There's enough about Ward in this book. there's probably, I had that, like, that big 10-page section, you know, wagon train section, where just before he drops down.
Sure.
And I thought, you know, I could lose this whole thing because it's a long book. It's 620 pages of text or something. And I thought about just lopping it out and cutting to the chase of Ward dropping dead. But I'd always wondered about Ward Bond, you know, and I was lucky to get Robert Horton to talk to me. And I never read any of that stuff about working with Ward on Wagon Train and what the experience was like and how difficult it could be and how crazy he could be. And at the same time, what a good actor. You know, his choices as an actor.
Oh, he's wonderful. Yeah.
We're always smart. And you try to, again, how could Ford make these wonderful emotional movies and act like that? How could Ward Bond be that kind of an actor and be that kind of a jerk at the same time? It's not just a question of being right wing. That's the least of it.
No.
That's the least of it. But I just wanted to leave it in for posterity, for some other guy. 20 years from now, or 50 years from now, who'll maybe pick up that information and figure out a way to use it. Because if I didn't use it, I'd never use it.
Sure.
Because I'm not going to write another book about John Wayne, and I'm not going to write another book about John Ford. Two is enough. And if I didn't put this Ward Bond information from Robert Horton in, who would know? So it was just sort of a little stone that I put on the cairn. You know, hoping someone else would put another stone on it at some point.
Yeah. Did you have this story in the Ford book? Because I seem to remember the different version, but Shirley Jones told me this version, that when they were making Two Road Together is when Ward Bond died.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ford flew off to Hollywood, comes back. When they see him driving back onto Happy Cheyenne's ranch, they all line up to greet him. Mm-hmm. And he gets out. She says he looked very old and very frail. And he walks down the line, checking everybody's hand. And so when he gets to Andy Devine, he says, "Well, now you're the biggest jackass in the world."
I believe it. That sounds like a...
Yeah.
That sounds like a... Terms of endearment.
Yeah.
Terms of endearment, you know.
Well, Scott, I've certainly enjoyed it. It's been a long time since we saw each other.
It's been too long. And, you know, it's just a conversation between old friends.
Yeah.
Which is the best kind.
I've been having a great time. So thanks very much for making time for me.
Happy to do it, Frank. I'll do it anytime you want.
Okay, tomorrow.
Okay.
Good.
I'm here.
I had a most enjoyable conversation with Scott Eyman, and I hope you enjoyed it. It was really fun talking with him. I met him at his hotel. He was in town for the Los Angeles Book Festival, and he also did a couple of book signings around town. And I met him in his downtown hotel, and his room was on the 30th floor with these huge glass windows. Most windows are made of glass, I've found, through my extensive experience in life. But these were huge windows with an incredible view. You know, anything... Even downtown Los Angeles looks pretty wonderful at 30 stories up. There's just something about height that makes everything look fine. And it was really beautiful. And then that hotel had these big glass elevators that are on the outside of the building. And so it's like having this wonderful crane shot as you go up and down. And it was quite a wonderful day. And just enjoyed so much talking with Scott. And I met his wife for the first time, and she was delightful. And it was just a good, good day. Now, speaking of Scott, were we? Yes, we were. Want to tell you that Turner Classic Movies is starting a week-long marathon of John Wayne films. And Scott will show up starting on Monday, April 21st, which is only the day after we're dropping this episode, so you have to move fast. I believe he's going to be with Robert Osborne introducing films all the week long. They're showing 55 John Wayne films over the week, which is a pretty good proposition. And they're showing a lot of the westerns from the early 30s where he cut his teeth after not doing as well as they had hoped on the Big Trail. He was kind of relegated to this purgatory of B-westerns for several years before Stagecoach. It's a mistake, I think, to just discount those and go straight from Big Trail to Stagecoach, because a lot of those films are a great deal of fun. They're not very important movies, and none of them probably will change your life in any way, but they're all really enjoyable, and it is fun watching John Wayne develop year by year and movie by movie and see what he's capable of. Great fun, and Scott will have a lot to say with Robert Osborne on TCM all next week, and I hope you'll enjoy that. I'm also told, and I don't have any real information on this yet, I'll keep you posted, but I'm told that there is a 40-disc John Wayne set coming out very soon, and so I don't know what the titles are yet, so I don't know whether to be tickled pink or just think, oh, that's nice, but if it's the right movies, it could be great, great fun. And 40 movies? How can you beat it? As I mentioned last week, we are doing a spin-off podcast playing classic radio shows based on movies, often with the same cast as in the films. And I'm going to be giving some introductions to give you some background about the films themselves and to talk a little bit about who was on the radio shows, and sometimes it's really great stuff. You know, my favorite director, William Wellman, introduces a radio version of Yellow Sky, and John Ford introduces films, and John Farrow and George Marshall and Frank Capra. It's really amazing to hear these guys, because you don't hear the directors that much, and then to hear radio versions with Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray and James Stewart and all these great stars recreating some of their movie roles. It's really fun stuff. You can hear a lot of these radio shows online pretty easily. You don't need me to do that. But what I plan to give as extra value added is just some historical perspective on these things and give you some nice intros. We're going to be dropping those on Thursdays. The commentary track, as you know, drops on Sundays, usually Sunday night, because I put it off as long as I can, just so long as it's ready for you first thing on Monday morning so you can start your work week off right. But then Thursday, we'll have the second one. And the only reason I'm not being more forthcoming about what that one is called is because I have not yet settled on a title for it. That actually might delay the debut of this for a week because I just can't come up with something that I like. Obviously, if you have any ideas, email me. Not saying I'll use them, but I could sure use some help. Right now I'm thinking radio movies, which is straightforward, but it might not be poetic enough. And then other stuff, you know, everything else that I've thought of, like Hollywood of the Air and that kind of thing, has already been taken by somebody else. So it would only be confusing. So that's coming up, and I hope that you will enjoy it. And I actually have a third spinoff coming, but that's still in the works, and I will give you more information on that as it comes up. But, yes, I'm building a podcast empire. That's what I'm doing. Because I figure of all the people who listen to the commentary track, if you multiply that by three, then we're going to get into double digits very soon. Very soon. So it's going to be great. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, sometimes known as Claire Thompson. It depends on what kind of form she's filling out. I want to thank her for being my wonderful announcer with her dulcet tones. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Thanks also to the wonderful and gifted Rob Clearfield and the great and legendary Gary Rand for writing my theme music fore and aft. I want to thank you, the listener, my friends, for passing the word along, telling others about the commentary track, making sure that everyone far and near in every Middlesex county and farm. County? I don't know. I must have missed something. Every Middlesex something and farm knows about the commentary track. So thank you very much. And we'll be back with another great one next week. We have the wonderful, the magnificent Lloyd Kaufman, head of Troma Pictures, who is just one of the greatest guys who ever lived in the history of the world. There should be a statue of him somewhere just saying, greatest guy of all time. Crazy about Lloyd Kaufman. He's my guest next week. You will have fun listening. So join me then. And until then, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.